I was looking for the section where the prototype demigods are mentioned and their prayers to the Supreme Lord. I couldn't find it right away. There is a place. There's a slight reference. Canto 3, Chapter 6, text number 10, where the universal form has just appeared, and then the Supreme Lord is the supersoul of all demigods entrusted with the task of constructing the cosmic manifestation, being thus prayed to by the demigods. He thought to himself and thus manifested the gigantic form, universal form, for their understanding. And this is before, again, before Garbhodakshaya Vishnu enters and so forth. There's the elements. The end of the purport, Prabhupada writes, the Lord can reveal himself only to a person who is submissive and who engages in his transcendental loving service. The demigods controlling the elements and ingredients of universal affairs prayed to the Lord for guidance, and thus he manifested his gigantic form as he did at the request of Arjuna. There's another section where there's their prayers after prayer after prayer after prayer, and they're praying for the intelligence, specifically, how to put the universe together, how to work in a cooperative way with one another, and so forth. And he responds by providing the universal form. Same thing, just a much shorter form here. So we're going back now to Canto 3, Chapter 20. Talks between Maitreya and Vidura, where we ended, text 16, was, well, there were some questions by Vidura to Maitreya. What did Brahma do after the last description that he gave about Lord Brahma? Specifically, the Prajapatis, such as Swayambhuva Manu and Marichi and others, what did they do? What did Brahma do? Did they take help from their wives? Did they do this on their own? Did they do it in cooperation with others? How did the rest of the creation unfold? So in his answer, Maitreya starts, he goes back to the unfolding of the elements from pradhan state, the glance of the Supreme Lord, time, living entities, and Shambhu, contact. Pradhan, the elements start to differentiate, starting with false ego according to the modes of nature, and then so many things, the elements separate out. We read, separately unable to produce the material universe, they combined with the help of the energy of the Supreme Lord and were able to produce a shining egg. So the universes are floating in the causal ocean for 1,000 celestial years. And then after that, the Lord then enters each universe as Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, the last verse we read, produces a effulgent, blazing like a thousand suns, lotus flower. Pretty intense. Blazing like a thousand suns. And the lotus flower is the reservoir of all conditioned souls. Well, at least all the conditioned souls within the universe, because remember, with the glance of Mahavishnu, the souls within Mahavishnu go into pradhan, then separates as mahatattva, so then now we're getting Garbhodakshaya Vishnu takes some portion of those into the universe that he's going to be functioning within. And now this lotus stem comes from his navel, which is, according to the verse that we read yesterday, it's the reservoir of all conditioned souls. And similarly, there's a verse in, this is chapter 20, so there's a verse in chapter 8 where it says that lotus that comes, protrudes from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. That's the force of the collective fruit of activities of all the living entities. Remember, there's creation by the force of time. When time is withdrawn, it dissolves. It goes back to the pradhan state. So when time is taken, karma subsides or is suspended. You know, it's like somebody that's under anesthesia. They're not doing anything, they're not receiving anything. they're just in that susupti state. Their karma is in abeyance. So now when time is again active, karma becomes again active. The living entities are within pradhan. The elements are there congealing around the universe, each seeds of the universe. Now Garbhodakshaya Vishnu enters, and with him he takes the living entities. Now their karma is becoming activated. The form in which their karma is activated first is the formation of the lotus coming from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So it's described as golden, like brilliant, as a thousand suns. So that's the living entity's brilliance. But then there's also their karma. Chapters 8 and chapter 20. Then what happens? Well, the first living entity of all the living entities within that stem appear, and that's Lord Brahma. Now, it doesn't go into detail, just like a really quick, minus the detail, statement. Text 17, that's the verse we're starting with this evening. When that Supreme Personality of Godhead, who was lying on the Garbhodak ocean, entered the heart of Brahma. So who's that entering the heart of Brahma? It's Shirodakshaya Vishnu. Brahma brought his intelligence to bear. That was quick, because a whole bunch of things actually happened. And with the intelligence invoked, he began to create the universe as it was before. So this is describing a day of Brahma. So it doesn't make a pronouncement, but as it was before means it's the day of Brahma. So the day of Brahma, what happens at the night of Brahma? There's a partial devastation. And the partial devastation is preceded by 100 years of drought, and then from the bottom of the universe, from the mouths of Anantashesh, comes fire, and the lower planets, being completely parched, dry, they ignite, they burst into flames. And the flames go through the lower planets up to Swargaloka. So at the end of the day of Brahma, during his night, there's a partial annihilation, Swargaloka down. Brihat Bhagavatamrita describes above that there's three: Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, Svargaloka. Then there's four more. Get seven and seven. Correct? Seven upper, seven lower. So Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, Satyaloka, or Brahmaloka. It says the residents of planetary region number four, Maharloka, it's unbearably hot. So they get in the Vimanas and they go like two regions higher. They don't go to Janaloka, they go to Tapaloka in their Vimanas, and they stay there for a long time till it cools off. Then they go back. And as it's approaching the next morning of Brahma, it's cool enough they can reside. And then when Brahma awakens, he gets his intelligence back, and he begins to create the universe as it was before. Purport. At a certain time, the personality Godhead, Karna Daksha Vishnu, lies in the Karna ocean and produces many thousands of universes from his breathing. That wasn't mentioned in the verses, but that's being mentioned in the purport. That's part of this creation process. Then he enters again into each and every universe as Garbhadakshay Vishnu and fills up half of each universe with his own perspiration. The other half of the universe remains vacant, and that vacant region is called outer space. Then the lotus flower sprouts from his abdomen and produces the first living creature, Brahma. Then again, as Shirodakshay Vishnu, the Lord enters into the heart of every living entity, including Brahma. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, 15th chapter. The Lord says, quote, I am seated in everyone's heart, and by me our remembrance and forgetfulness made possible. As the witness of the activities of the individual entities, the Lord gives each one remembrance and intelligence to act according to his desire at the time he was annihilated, in his last birth, in the last millennium. This intelligence is invoked according to one's own capacity, or by the law of karma. So each soul, each entity is endowed with different intelligence, different because of their capacity to receive, they're given. And that's dependent upon their previous karma, more or less. Heavier karma, less intelligence. Lighter karma, more intelligence. But it's not yet Krishna conscious intelligence or Vyavasayatmika Buddhi intelligence. It's some intelligence. How to conduct one's affairs. But Brahma is the most intelligent, so he's the firstborn. Brahma was the first living entity, and he was empowered by the Supreme Lord to act in charge of the mode of passion. Therefore, he was given the required intelligence, which is so powerful and extensive that he is almost independent of the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as a highly posted manager is almost independent as the owner of the firm. Brahma is described here as independent because as the Lord's representative to control the universe, he is almost as powerful and independent as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord, as the super soul within Brahma, gave him the intelligence to create. You know this, what's it? Both the Kena Upanishad and Katha Upanishad, Parashya Shaktir Vividaiva Shruyate Sobhaviki Jnana Bala Kriya. So remember the glance is the time energy, and according to Bhakti Siddhanta, one purport, at the very end of the purport, I forget which one it is, he says this time energy has two constituents. The force of activity, or Kriya Shakti, and the will of the Lord, or Icha Shakti. Actually, it's the will of Rama Devi, who understands the will of the Lord. But so it's none different than her will is his will. And his will is her will. So those are two. This Icha Shakti is also Bala. So Bala Kriya, and now here's where the part that was missing, because the elements are the time energy agitates, the elements separate, the demigods of each of the elements reside within those elements, that's the residential place. The elements enlarge the seed, so the universes start to form, but they're not in this cooperative position yet. So they pray, the universal form is generated, and also the Lord enters within the heart of Brahma and the demigods to give them the intelligence. So the force of activity, that's the karma of the living entity producing this stem and the lotus, the bud at the top. The karma is being activated. Force of the will of the Supreme Lord is there to move the thing along, but they don't have the intelligence, so Krishna enters, or the Vishnu enters into the heart of Brahma and the demigods, and now they can do their cooperative work. Without the direction of the Supreme Lord, it can't happen. It doesn't happen until he does it. The Lord, as the super soul within Brahma, gave him the intelligence to create. The creative power, therefore, of every living entity is not his own. It is by the grace of the Lord that one can create. There are many scientists and great workers in this material world who have wonderful creative force, but they act and create only according to the direction of the Supreme Lord. A scientist may create many wonderful inventions by the direction of the Lord, but it is not possible for him to overcome the stringent laws of material nature by his own intelligence, nor is it possible to acquire such intelligence from the Lord, for the Lord's supremacy would then be hampered. It is stated in this verse that Brahma created the universe as it was before. This means that he created everything by the same name and form as in the previous cosmic manifestation. He's like grandfather, Pitamaha. He's the sire, grandsire, and he's the teacher of the living entities who he's the father of. He also gives knowledge according to their capacity and according to their previous karma, just like a teacher does. Just like a teacher does. And the knowledge that he has comes from the Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord being situated within the heart of other living beings, they still require a teacher, although the Lord is within their heart. The Lord is the one who taught Brahma. They don't have the capacity that Brahma has. They must receive from a teacher who has received from the Lord, or from one who has received from disciplic succession from the Lord. But it's knowledge that's already there. It's just being awakened through that process of sound vibration from the teacher to the student. Okay, text 18. It's going to start getting a little more technical, as if it wasn't already. Text 18. First of all, Brahma created from his own shadow the coverings of ignorance of the conditioned souls. They are five in number and are called Tamishra, Andhatamishra, Tamas Moha, and Mahamoha. Purport. The conditioned souls, or the living entities who come into the material world to enjoy sense gratification, are covered in the beginning by five different conditions. The first condition is a covering of tamishra, or anger. Constitutionally, each and every living entity has minute independence. It is misuse of that minute independence for the conditioned soul to think that he can enjoy like the Supreme Lord, or to think, why shall I not be a free enjoyer like the Supreme Lord? This forgetfulness of his constitutional position is due to anger or envy. The living entity, being eternally a part and parcel servitor of the Supreme Lord, can never, by constitution, be an equal enjoyer with the Lord. When he forgets this, however, he tries to be one with him. His condition is called Tamishra. Even in the field of spiritual realization, this Tamishra mentality of living entity is hard to overcome. In trying to get out of the entanglement of material life, there are many who want to become one with the Supreme. Even in their transcendental activities, this lower grade mentality of Tamasha continues. So watch out. Then, next one. Anta Tamasha involves considering death to be the ultimate end. The one-liner, Professor Katovsky. Swamiji. After death, everything's finished. The atheists generally think that the body is the self and that everything is therefore ended with the end of the body. Thus, they want to enjoy material life as far as possible during the existence of the body. Their theory is, quote, as long as you live, you should live prosperously. Never mind whether you commit all kinds of so-called sins, you must eat sumptuously, beg, borrow, and steal, and if you think that by stealing and borrowing, you are being entangled in sinful activities for which you will have to pay, then just forget that misconception, because after death everything is finished. No one is responsible for anything he does during his life, unquote. That's pandemonium. Besides wrong. This atheistic conception of life is killing human civilization, for it is without knowledge of the continuation of eternal life. We got Tamishra and Anta Tamishra. Three more to go. Take your pick or combination. Anta Tamishra, ignorance is due to tamas. The condition of not knowing anything about the spirit soul is called tamas. This material world is also generally called tamas because 99% of its living entities are ignorant of their identity as soul. Almost everyone is thinking that he is the body. He has no information of the spirit soul. Guided by this misconception, one always thinks, this is my body. And anything in relationship with the body is mine. For such misguided living entities, sex life is the background of material existence. Actually, the conditioned souls, in ignorance in this material world are simply guided by sex life. And as soon as they get the opportunity for sex life, they become attached to so-called home, motherhood, children, wealth, and opulence. As these attachments increase, moha, or the illusion of the bodily concept of life, also increases. Thus, the idea that I am this body and everything belonging to this body is mine also increases. And as the whole world is put into moha, sectarian societies, families, and nationalities are created, and they fight with one another. Maha moha means to be mad after material enjoyment, especially in this age of Kali. Everyone is overwhelmed by the madness to accumulate paraphernalia for material enjoyment. These definitions are very nicely given in Vishnu Purana, where it is said, everything that he said is just the Sanskrit. End of purport. Well, while Brahma has all this intelligence, he has a tough job. Got to do all these things that moha, maha moha, tamishra, anta tamishra. Tamas. So if you ever were thinking that being Brahma might be nice, you know, in here in America, what the fastest growing religion is today? At least one report says it's the Mormon faith. Part of it is they're very active in their missionary work. And do you know what the goal or the topmost attainment for a Mormon follower is? Become Lord Brahma. You don't have to press them too hard. They're a little like shy to say it, but they'll say it. The goal is to become the creator of this universe, the creator of a universe. Are you surprised? Because, I mean, one thinks, well, Christian is monotheism. There's Christ taught to love God. And, you know, what's the aspiration to become the creator of the universe? Well, it's like a servant of God. But their idea is not like a servant of God creating the universe. Their idea is God. I haven't found anyone who I can have this kind of refined discussion with, where what's the difference between, do you see a difference between the creator of the universe, Brahma, and God? And the best answer I've gotten so far is no. You become God. Sounds impersonal, doesn't it? Worshipping God so they can become God. Sounds like. And somehow Christ taught that. I mean, I don't get it. But it's very popular. Not so much because people want to become Lord Brahma or creator of the universe. It's more, they have very strong family values. Very strong family values. And people like that because the family values are very weak in the West, and where the family values are strong, that there's some protection. At least religious people find like there's some protection in that. Anyway, one can also become Brahma, but it's not an easy job. The description that's found in Brahma Vaivarta Purana, I think, about the appearance of a Kadasi day. You know the history, how Kadasi became manifest? It's a Puranic description that says after he completed the creation, the Lord Brahma, like anyone would do, he steps back to look at how did it come out. Right? You address the deities and you step back and you look how did it come out. Or you write a paper and, you know, you spend a lot of time writing the paper and then you step back and go, how did it come out, right? Like that. So you cook an offering and you're very curious to see, do people like it? How did it come out? So that's what Brahma did. He was looking at the creation and he thought, oh my God, this is awful. There's so much suffering and anguish and grief and despair and look what I've done, this awful thing. So with that thought, he then invested the fullness of auspiciousness in the Ekadasi day. And anyone who observes Ekadasi very nicely gets enormous relief from all the sinfulness of the material creation. So, following that act, sin personified, Papa Purush, came and complained. Look what you've done. You created all this, and you created me, and now you've created a codicil, and there's no place for me, and I'm finished. That's not very nice. Not right. You should give me some place where I can reside on the codicil day. And, you know, do my sinful thing. So, Brahma then said, very well, you can reside in beans and grains on the Kadasi day. So, don't eat beans and grains on the Kadasi day. But the Kadasi day is a very, very auspicious day for spiritual progress. invested specifically by the Creator for whatever unfortunate activities, unintentional activities may have been performed in the course of time, then there are at least, you know, karmakanda practices, for example, for counteracting those bad and receiving good reactions or benefits by observing Ekadasi this way, that way, the other way. And Vaishnavas see it as a very auspicious day for furthering one's spiritual advancement, and by furthering spiritual advancement, just like we know what Krishna says, Ham tam sarva papebhyo moksha yashami masur shaha. By surrendering unto him, automatically that takes care of sinful reactions, and trying to direct attention through hearing and chanting and other means on Ekadasi day, increasing hearing and chanting helps free one from further. It's like especially potent and especially effective. So we minimize our bodily activity and increase our hearing and chanting activity on the Ekadasi day. So that's something that Brahma was very happy with. Ekadasi day. But the creation has lots of problems otherwise for the conditioned soul. Okay. Any discussion? The Mormons. Now back to the Mormons. If their process is not sufficient to make them a creator, they have some interesting ideas. They believe in transmigration of the soul, but they believe that it's only upwards, which doesn't sound like what Christ speaks of. It's heaven and hell, but they only speak of going upwards. So, like, you know, then you go, what's the furthest upwards? You create, you know, you're the Lord of the universe. You create the universe. That's the furthest upwards. So you become like the best Mormon around, the perfect Mormon, and that's what happens. It's like boop, 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 boop. I don't know the whole, you know, ology, the whole ism, the whole doctrine, but that, like, that's, yeah, when you meet someone, just, you know, politely, just out of curiosity, I'd like to know, I heard something about this, could you illuminate, verify? Yes. So I don't know the whole picture. It seems like, from a distance, it seems like it's based on piety creates pious merit. And with pious merit, then there's prosperity, you know, that paradigm. And with prosperity, then you just, you know, you continue going and create good progeny, and there's dynasties, and, you know, as long as your dynasty is like a good Mormon, you know, you get the merit of them plus yourself and just keep going. Something like that. So family values are really, really important, and having lots of children seems to be similarly like something that they value. And, but, you know, that each family member is very pious and very, very, you know, good follower. I don't know what more than that. That's the Vedic picture. Well, they don't have necessarily the same picture. See where that fits into the Vedic picture? There may be some detail where, you know, you continue, like, say you're a Mormon. I don't know if they have, you know, planes of heaven, and then, you know, beyond the planes of heaven, they may have some idea like that. You, with your family, all the, you know, everybody, you go to heaven, you do this, you know, you're a good Mormon in heaven, and you go to the next pillar. They may have different realms. I don't know. I don't know. I haven't inquired. Can it be done in one lifetime, or does it take many lifetimes? It would be a question. And if it's many lifetimes, then what happens between now and when you become Brahma? What's in between here and there? I'm guessing. Different realms. And you do, you know, nice Mormon things. Don't know. Yes. They're not, doesn't, from my senses, it's not just degrees, it's different aspects of, as well as degrees, like, moha and mahamoha. That's degrees. But then there's also aspects of mahamoha that's, you know, like not exactly what moha is, not like a bigger pile of it. That's just degrees. Should I read it again? Oops, that's the wrong volume. Well, it's let's go. It does sound like there's something to do with degrees. On the Tamrisha, ignorance is due to tamas. The condition of not knowing anything about the spirit soul is called tamas. And then there's this under tamishra, is considering death to be the ultimate end. So then moha is the sum total of all material attachments. It mentioned this one, that one, that one, the other one, the other one. Sum total is moha, or illusion of the bodily conception of life, increases. Thus the idea of I am this body, everything belongs to this body, is mine, also increases. And as the whole world is put into moha, sectarian societies, families, nationalities, they fight. Maha moha means to be mad after material enjoyment. So it's kind of, as you said, degrees. But it's also like somebody can have moha and mahamoha at the same time. Bodily conception and attachment to objects of material enjoyment and the mood of trying to enjoy them. The objects. I am mine, and particularly strongly attracted to enjoying spirit. Yeah, it was cyclically. Eternally, in the sense, one could say, because living entities haven't come back yet. But there's the other aspect of his external energy and wishing for her to have something to do. The metaphor is used as a man whose wife is sleeping and he wants to enjoy with his wife. And he very quickly says, this is a metaphor. But, you know, because Krishna isn't like that, the man that's wanting to enjoy his sleeping wife. But like that, so we have some idea, he wishes her to have some enjoyment. So wishes for her to have some service. So the picture, I guess you could say, you know, it's ongoing. At the same time that the Lord is completely full in his happiness, it's something like, you know, wishing Krishna is forever inviting the conditioned souls to enjoy with him in an ever-loving serving mode. But, you know, they're saying no. You know, like these, most of the conditioned souls are not paying any attention. So he isn't like, okay, forget you guys. It's still there. While he's on the one hand full, he's also wishing. And like a follower of Lord Chaitanya is thinking, let me relieve the anxiety of the Supreme Lord that these conditioned souls should come back to him. And, you know, relieve this desire of the Supreme Lord that now they can come back to him. And he can enjoy in their company. And they can be relieved of their distress, unnecessary distresses, illusory distresses. So in one sense, it's ongoing. But the specific mention of this is, the living entities are in his abdomen or in his body, in this dormant state. And he's omniscient, and he knows that they're there, and he knows that they're not in their proper relationship with him. He wishes that they become So, like that. And that's the icha that brings about the creation. So then there's this withdrawal of the creation. It's not like, oh, I don't care anymore. So ongoing but intermittent, one can say both. And in Sri Brahma Samhita especially, you know, multiple places, again and again, it speaks of enjoying his pastimes with his eternal internal potency. And in that, in Bhaktisiddhanta's language, there's a number of terms that practically, it's the same personality, Rama Devi, but sometimes she's referred to as Yogamaya. Sometimes she's referred to as Yoganidra. Sometimes she's referred to as Niyati. And my understanding of that is, the different nomenclature is there to indicate a different aspect of the same energy, the same potency. So she's called by a specific name because of a specific aspect of her. But Yoganidra is specifically within. Like, commonly when we see Mahavishnu, we don't see Rama Devi because she's within. When we see Garbhadakshaya Vishnu or Shirodakshaya Vishnu in the ocean of milk, there's the goddess of fortune massaging his feet. But Rama Devi is within. That's this Yoga Nidra. He's in the mystic slumber, and he's enjoying his eternal pastimes with her within. And it's not just like, you know, like our sleep. We're out of it. He's enjoying his eternal pastimes with Rama Devi within. Yoga Nidra. Then she's known by that name. He's enjoying his pastime of Yoga Nidra. While that's going on, this other is going on. Feeling something and so forth. But that's the cause of creation. You can say, I like it particularly in contrast to, you know, a causeless event, whether it's Big Bang or the primordial soup model. There's no cause, it just exploded. You know, where did the singularity come from? Don't ask. And, you know, what caused it to explode? Don't ask. It's just some moment it exploded. No cause. So, here, our picture is the cause is the source of all energies, and he has a desire, and following that desire, something happens. The material creation happens. And preceding that, in those preceding verses, there's this nice discussion about the spiritual world and Bhaktisiddhanta's incredible language, his infinitary aspect manifests the spiritual world. That's ananta, infinitary aspect. So, and ananta is an expansion of Baladev or Balaram, who manifests the whole spiritual world and all the paraphernalia of the spiritual world and everything for the Lord's enjoyment through his infinitary aspect. So he's enjoying in the spiritual world, and then there are those living entities that are rebellious, and that this other thing is just comes next. Mahavishnu's considering. And it's, anyway, this is just my like little appreciation. He's enjoying his eternal pastimes internally with Rama Devi, and time is conspicuous by its absence because it's eternal. Nonetheless, it's almost like tick tick, Tick, tick. Oh, there's the Chaya Devi. There's my external manifestation of Rama Devi, and she has nothing to do. And then, you know, it's on a scheduled time. The creation begins again, and then it's withdrawn for a certain period of time. Although he's situated, it's fascinating to me. It's not like he's not controlled by time. Time is under his control, but it's nonetheless cyclical and regulated by his own will. That's how it happens. He's not controlled by time like we are. We're born and we die, and everything in between is by the force of time. He's not forced by time. Time is under his control. Rama Devi is under his control, and time is his expansion. But while it's Rama Devi, then it's eternal time, the conspicuous by its absence kind of time. And then when he desires creation, then she transforms herself and the energies entrusted to Shambhu with a glance of the Supreme Lord, and off the living entities go, along with the time energy. But then it's no longer this eternal time, it's the expansion of her. So just like, it's the picture. Aside from the details and all the technology and stuff, it's the picture of the Supreme Person, and he's enjoying these first few verses. He's in the spiritual world, and he's in the center of the world, and then there's the petals of the flower are said to be the abodes of the gopis, and then there's the abodes of all the other, residents of the spiritual world. So that's like the first picture. And so then we go to Mahavishnu, and this is another Leela. It's a Svangsa expansion, a plenary expansion of the Supreme Lord to address the other living entities that aren't in this realm. They're the body of Mahavishnu, at least during the annihilation phase, and then this cyclical thing. Time, as we know it, is cyclical. But he's not dependent upon the cyclical. He's in the eternal time position. But for the sake of, out of compassion for the living entities, desiring their happiness to be again in the loving position with him, he does. And so Dharma, along with the creation, we know from chapter 3 Bhagavad Gita, along with creation comes in Dharma, the principle of sacrifice. So they can stay connected with the Supreme, and ultimately, ideally, rectify their deviant mentality. It's all for that higher purpose. In Bhaktisiddhanta's language, it's to rejoin their position in the rasa dance, or to rejoin their position of eternal pastimes with the Supreme Lord, loving exchange with the Supreme Lord. So everything, at the top is, essential is Dharma, at least for human form of life. And then there are gradations of Dharma, and then there is Sarva Dharma Parinijamamikam. So that's the top. And then within that, there's degrees of perfection within the top. But all of it is for the purpose of the living entities having a desire, and the Lord having a desire to return them to their spiritual position. And that's what's going on. And it's very intricate, cause and effect intricate. He's the cause of all causes, and those downstream, so many effects of those causes become themselves causes of the next effect. And then he withdraws it. And is resting. He's independently enjoying, at the same time he's affecting this whole creation through the transformation of his energies, just by his willing, these two wills. This, my energy should have something to do, a living entity should have the opportunity to be situated in their loving position again. And the whole thing happens. And he's enjoying his yoga nidra pastimes, and Krishna's enjoying in the Goloka Vrindavan, in this, Goloka realm, with Radha and the gopis and everybody. at inviting us. Please come. It's quite a different picture than Big Bang cosmology. Following. Sure. It makes him happy. Because it's a step towards returning to that position. And specifically, where was it? Just maybe it's something that you're reading. But you know, one the protection of the Lord goes to those who follow Dharma. And we say, you can say it differently. Those who protect Dharma are protected by Dharma. Dharma rakshata rakshataha. But you know, where does Dharma come from? The Supreme Lord, so He protects them. Those that are dharmic get protected. Those that are adharmic, like you're reading, Hiranyakashipus and so forth, they're adharmic, they're not protected. They're destroyed by their own devices. Anyway, he's enjoying. We may be thinking we're doing it so that we can be the enjoyer. That's like little child something. Very immature. But, you know, the parents are happy even that he's doing something good. Even the spirit behind it isn't so good. Or it isn't like the real. So, to direct in a sense-controlled, mind-controlled, dry wood, igniting kind of way of life where Krishna being pleased is everything. And, you know, the purpose behind the vidhis is that one. Rather than whatever it is, weight control or, you know, good health or something. Those things will be there. Just what's the purpose? Love, bhakti. And that can be received from one who has bhakti. So then what someone might say, well, gee, you know, something like, why didn't Krishna arrange it so there's like lots of bhaktas running around with lots of bhakti and then everyone will be happy? You know, living entities are rebellious. He wants. They're saying no. Someone asked that question. I remember as a brahmachari going on traveling sankirtana, just driving around this huge country, what to speak of the world. There's so many people all over the place, and they don't know anything about this. And what about them? Where's Krishna in the picture for them? And then the answer is, well, just like what Prabhupada did, he sacrificed and he gave and found out some people know something instead of nothing. And some of those people that know something instead of nothing, some are misusing it. Some are, you know, properly using it. Anyway. And then all over the world. So this, you know, somebody was asking just this past week, you go to China, the people, so many people in China, they don't know anything about this. They don't know anything about God. What's the deal? Then the other side is it's a waste of time. Yeah. What's the dry wood that doesn't ignite? Like Bhagavatam. Fire is better, smoke is better than raw earth and so on. It really helps a lot when reading these subject matters to bear in mind the big picture and not just get lost in the technology of the push and pull, the cause and effect. Because it's easy for the mind to get wired into the cause and effect and forget the big picture. Just like life. like what's happening in the moment, and how do I deal with this circumstance or that situation or something, and forget the big picture, like the purpose of life, the purpose of why this is an opportunity being presented to me to serve Krishna in some way. And, you know, don't forget Krishna, always remember Krishna. But reading through these things, you know, just step back and what's happening here? Why is this in the Bhagavatam? We heard a little bit in the purport this morning, this afternoon. To appreciate how great is God, the workings of his energies. He's all potent. And this is just one small portion of his totality of his potency. Anyway. The greatness of God. Okay. Hare Krishna. Prabhupada ki jai.